Before we get into the episode, a quick reminder that this podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only, and nothing should be construed as investment or legal advice. If you are enjoying OnRamp Media content, please like, subscribe, and share, as it goes a long way in helping others find the signal through the noise. Now for a word from OnRamp. OnRamp is a Bitcoin asset management platform built on multi-institution custody, leveraging our partnership with BitGo and their 10-plus year track record in securing assets, and CoinCover, the premier digital asset risk mitigation company. OnRamp's multi-institution custody is a segregated, institutional-grade vault, requiring two of three institutions at any point in time to sign once a client's unique permissions have been met. At OnRamp, we understand that your Bitcoin journey is a multi-generational pursuit, catalyzed by the ideals of perseverance, aspiration, and legacy. That's why we're proud to introduce OnRamp Heritage, a suite of private client services dedicated to ensuring your Bitcoin legacy is preserved and passed on, embodying the true essence of wealth that goes beyond mere numbers. If you would like to learn more, please schedule a consultation. As we prepare for the Bitcoin halving and the next wave of global adoption of this nascent and growing asset class, we are halving all annual maintenance fees for clients that secure their wealth before the next Bitcoin epoch.
Let's be clear. Bitcoin is an international asset.
We are spending like drunken sailors.
Bitcoin is the only economic entity where the supply is unaffected by the demand.
If you want to preserve your wealth, you have to convert that currency into an asset that's scarce, desirable, portable, durable, and maintainable.
Hello, my name is Andy Edstrom, and I'm happy to welcome you to the eighth episode of Scarce Assets, a show that examines scarcity, the most fundamental driver of economics and markets, and the scarcest asset of all, which is Bitcoin. I'm delighted to be here with my great friend and co-host, Jesse Myers, and our guest, the great Samson Moe. Now I'm going to say a few things about Samson. Samson is a Bitcoin OG that I've been following for years. And back in 2019, he organized a conference in New York called the Magical Crypto Conference, which was an important event in my Bitcoin journey. It was a great event, and it's where I first met and had conversations with not only Samson, but a number of Bitcoin luminaries, including Jimmy Song, Max Keiser, Nick Carter, John Pfeffer, Luke Dasher, and others. It was a significant milestone on my personal journey, and it really helped me focus my attention on Bitcoin. Now, Samson has been building Bitcoin companies for a long time. He was chief strategy officer for Blockstream. He was COO at BTC China. Before Bitcoin, he built a successful career in game development and has numerous credits to his name in that field. And now he's the founder and CEO of JN3, which we're going to learn more about in this conversation. Also, his Twitter X account is super bullish, which I always enjoy. So I'm delighted to welcome Samson to the show. Samson, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on, Andy. And good to see you again, Jesse.
You too, Samson.
Excellent. Well, let's just get right into it. Samson, I hear you've been meeting with governments and talking about Bitcoin here and there. Here in 2024, do you think that's the most interesting frontier for Bitcoin adoption these days?
I think it's one of the most important frontiers for Bitcoin adoption. And not so much as the importance of getting a country to buy Bitcoin or implement a Bitcoin strategy, but just acting as a bulwark against poorly thought out backwards regulatory frameworks like we're seeing in the EU now. So I think the initiatives that we have at Gen 3, going out there and engaging with governments and politicians, it's helping to educate them on what Bitcoin is, maybe on what may or may not be good regulatory policy. And, you know, the icing on the cake is really if we can get them to take a liking to Bitcoin, appreciate Bitcoin, and adopt some form of Bitcoin strategy for their country. But at the very minimum, I think we are trying to at least, you know, engage to prevent bad things from happening to the people of those countries, not so much to Bitcoin.
That's right. Bitcoin will probably be fine either way. But I'd love to learn a little bit about, you know, what resonates in those meetings with government officials. is it that Bitcoin is better than gold and therefore the value will rise? Is it the, you know, the censorship resistant? I mean, what are some factors or characteristics that you find resonate with folks in governments?
Well, Bitcoin is better than gold, but we don't usually get into that. In fact, we don't get too far into the nuance of Bitcoin and like things that we might find cool, like the 21 million limit, the halving, or things like that. We approach it from a very high level, and we try to align the incentives of the governments with what Bitcoin could do for them. So it's very focused on tangible near-term things that can be of immediate benefit to those countries. So as an example, we met with the president of Colombia. I don't think they're going to implement a Bitcoin legal tender law anytime soon or adopt Bitcoin as money. They don't see it that way. But he does have emissions targets that he wants to meet. So we talked a lot about how Bitcoin as an ESG-friendly technology can help them reduce flare gas and methane emissions. And he was very keen to start work on that. And it's just a matter of moving along that process because, as you know, governments take a long time to do things. So it's like a oil tanker. They have to turn around slowly. But these are sort of the angles we approach. What can Bitcoin do for you? If you're a developing country and you have a massive amount of energy reserves, then we might come at it from an angle of you can tap into Bitcoin and mine Bitcoin and sell it to buy whatever you need. You can buy people to build roads, airports, a rail transit system, whatever you need. But it's always focused on what Bitcoin can help them with what they are concerned about, rather than Bitcoin is the best form of money ever and there is no second best and you need it now or else you're going to have fun staying poor, which is true, but it doesn't come off that well.
Yeah. That's super interesting to hear. It's like, of course that makes sense. It's driven by like the near term problems that are top of mind for these leaders and what they're trying to solve, because, you know, they're trying to assess, they've made promises to the electorate. They're trying to assess their performance against those promises. They're trying to hit those targets. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's top of mind.
Yeah.
What are some,
unfortunately, politics is cyclical, much like the halving. It's a 4-year cycle. Mm-hmm. 4 to 5 year cycle. So the time frame in which there is political will coupled with understanding of Bitcoin is a very narrow window, because when they're nearing the end of the term and if they're getting ready for a re-election, they're not going to want to rock the boat. Mm-hmm. And then they focus on, you know, core problems or core issues, not so much other things. But it's just hitting that sweet spot of getting them to understand Bitcoin and how Bitcoin can help them, aligned with that schedule in which they have the mandate and the will to do something.
Yeah, that's another interesting layer there of like you really have like a, maybe it's 6 months, maybe it's 18 months where people are really actually like willing to step out and learn about something new and implement something that's a bit radical from the perspective of, you know, traditional approach to solving problems internally and especially finance. But so besides emissions targets, are there other use cases or you know, low-hanging fruit that people latch onto at that level? Like, because I can remember when El Salvador was getting into Bitcoin, one of the main talking points was how such a large percentage of their GDP was international remittances. Mm-hmm. And that Western Union takes like a like effective like 20% cut of all of that flow coming in, and how, you know, the Lightning Network would turn all of that money captured by Western Union into GDP for El Salvador, and it would bump GDP. I think the numbers were crazy, like 7% boost to GDP if you completely converted from Western Union to Bitcoin. In my mind, that was like a huge talking point, a huge use case for adoption of Bitcoin. I don't know that it has made that much traction in on that front yet, at least. But to me, that seemed like a politician's easy win to talk up. What other categories stand out like that?
Well, that is a really big category, but the challenge with that one is that they would have to have a very good understanding of money to appreciate Bitcoin's ability to bypass that legacy system, which is extracting rent effectively. So the fortunate thing for El Salvador is that President Bukele was a Bitcoiner before he was president. A lot of the heads of state that we are engaging with today are not Bitcoiners. So we're kind of going from zero, or maybe a little bit further than zero, but we have a ways to go before they can fully grasp what Bitcoin can fix, because Bitcoin can fix so many things. The energy and emissions thing seems to be top of mind for a lot of people these days. So that is an easier avenue, I think, to pursue. It's more straightforward, which is you have a 30-foot flare here. We can get rid of that. It's much more simple to get than saying, well, if you made Bitcoin legal tender, well, then you make a wallet, you can provide liquidity for your citizens, and they can do remittances over Bitcoin and Lightning. And it's a little bit more complex there. But I think there are avenues to engage with some of these countries, potentially with stable coins, because a lot of the South America, Latin America countries have a large amount of remittances around stable coins. So maybe you could talk to them about that angle. But Bitcoin is a bit further out there. And of course, the standard pushback you get is, well, how can it do that? Because it's so volatile. So you have you open up a can of worms, I think, if you go in too deep to these arguments sometimes. But you're right that it is a huge booster. And we've seen double-digit GDP growth in El Salvador. I think their fees to these remittance companies alone was in the tens of millions a year, maybe 30 to 40 million a year. So it's not trivial savings when you really think about it, especially when people's earnings per month is relatively low in those countries.
Yeah, tens of millions goes a long way in a not huge population country like El Salvador, for sure. So speaking of not Bitcoiners, you know, being in charge in most countries, is there usually at least one sort of well-placed Bitcoiner in an administration? I mean, is there someone who's helping set up the conversation, you know, kind of bridge things, or is that rare?
I would say so. I mean, you'd be surprised at how many of us there are and where we are. It's like we're everywhere. But we won't be able to get these meetings as Gen 3 without people on the ground helping us. So there's always somebody either in the administration or close to the administration that helps us tee things up and opens that door, and then we can come in. But yeah, you'd be surprised. Like I met with the Guatemalan Central Bank before, and it was a committee of some senior people there, and we asked them, how many of you have Bitcoin? And I think all but a handful said they didn't. So everyone wants Bitcoin. Everyone's a Bitcoiner. They just don't know it yet.
Well, that's it. That's it. If Bitcoin reaches its potential, and we think that is quite likely, then yes, most of the world will be using it. Well, you mentioned the issue of volatility, obviously, in purchasing power of Bitcoin. My sense is that one of the things you're doing Jan 3 in the wallet department, you know, helps with respect to that, especially what you're doing with respect to Tether. I'd love to understand that that better, and sort of why you've designed the wallet that way, and what you think it accomplishes.
Sure. So in case you don't know, Aqua is a Bitcoin and Layer 2 wallet. It's a wallet that supports Bitcoin main chain, and then there's a Layer 2 wallet that supports both Liquid and Lightning. Liquid is a Bitcoin sidechain, and it has assets that can be issued in that sidechain, like USDT and other stablecoins. I think now there's a Brazilian real stablecoin too. But it's just a way that Bitcoin can scale using another tech, and it lets you issue these assets natively. So Tether issues on Liquid just like it does on all the other altcoin blockchains like Tron and Ethereum and Solana, etc. But the difference is, when you're using Tether on Liquid, it's sort of more pure. You don't have to buy Tron or Ethereum for gas fees. You're just using Bitcoin to transport it. And in one of the next releases in Aqua, we'll actually let you pay for network fees in Liquid with USDT. So I think this is a big game changer. But the premise of Aqua is that we want to create a wallet that is very useful for people. it's not just a Bitcoin wallet for Bitcoiners, but for people that want to protect their savings. I think that's a bigger cohort than just Bitcoiners. And you see a lot of people in LATAM that want to protect their savings from inflation and hyperinflation. And what they're doing is they're seeking out the dollar or dollar denominated value. They may not be able to get dollars in their bank account because they may not have a bank account. So they try to either get physical cash or they try to get a stable coin like Tether. And it's hard to get physical cash. There's just not that much of it around. The bulk of the money that's printed is not physical, but digital. So what they end up doing is gravitating towards like Tron, Tether on Tron or Tether on Ethereum, etc. And we think that by creating a Bitcoin wallet that also puts stable coins up at the forefront, like it's right in your face when you download the wallet, we can bring these people into the Bitcoin ecosystem, into on-chain Bitcoin as a savings mechanism, but potentially layer two, and they can receive Lightning payments and then convert that to Tether. And that's just a way to meet them where they are at in their level of understanding. So they understand my currency is the peso and it's dying. I want the dollar. They don't yet understand that the dollar is dying and they want Bitcoin. But with Aqua, we think we can get them across that hurdle and understanding a little bit more about sound money.
Yeah, I love that angle, meeting people where they are. That you've lived it before. The history of Bitcoin is riddled with overzealous Bitcoiners who are providing solutions that either aren't in demand. Well, at least they aren't in demand just yet. And this being the scarce assets show, you know, we like to think about scarcity. You mentioned how scarce U.S. physical dollars are in foreign jurisdictions. We sometimes forget how scarcity is not necessarily global and absolute, except in the case of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. But the different commodities and different assets have different scarcity levels in different locations. Yeah, that's fascinating. Do you find that you know, with your adoption of the wallet so far, do you find that people are already focusing on the dollar and the Tether and the stablecoin element, or are they, you know, does the activity suggest that they're getting interested in Bitcoin, or is it just too early to know?
I think it's too early. We haven't really started pushing Aqua yet. So far the user base is just people that like it and are probably Bitcoiners. We haven't done much marketing in LATAM yet. We're waiting until we finish our Charlie release, which is when we can pay network fees in Tether. And at that point, we'll start adding more local fiat on and off ramp integrations. And once we've got a handful of those, I think we should have one for Brazil relatively soon, and hopefully one in Argentina. That's the point at which we really start pushing it aggressively. But we've just done some fun stuff. Like we put up a few billboards here and there. We had some on the ground initiatives where we had two people going around getting them to install the wallet and sending them sats over Lightning. So fun stuff to test the waters, but nothing really serious yet. But I think once we really have the integrations in place and we really push it, we should start to see more and more traction of Tether in Liquid and in Aqua, simply because it's superior to all the other options out there. You have confidential transactions. You have more reliability. So when you send a Tron or Ethereum payment, first of all, it's more expensive, but it's like a dollar for Tron usually. The wallet's just set a set fixed fee. But for Ethereum, it can go up to like $13, $14. But these chains, they're not UTXO-based like Bitcoin with a mempool. They're account-based systems where, I don't know how to explain it, but their transactions can fail and just disappear. So it's not like you get your money back. If you lowball a Bitcoin transaction and it goes out there and it doesn't confirm ever, you actually get it back in your wallet eventually, like maybe after a few weeks. But for these other chains, it just disappears and you lost the fee that you paid to send it to. So I think with Liquid, you actually get a far superior user experience and cheaper too.
Yeah, no, it sounds like a much better experience. One of always the problems with Bitcoin and crypto overall has been, lost transactions. Things, it's final settlement, but if it doesn't go through, either it took longer than you thought, you got worried and you started sweating bullets, or yeah, God forbid, it just never goes through. Mm-hmm. Well, I've downloaded the wallet on my iPhone. I think this is it. It's got, I got to say, it's got a pretty clean interface, and it's as you've stated, it's got savings account. It says Bitcoin, spending accounts, layer two Bitcoin, Liquid and Lightning, and then Tether USD. And it's all, you know, it's all right up there.
Yeah. I do love how you guys categorize this savings account and spending account. That's nomenclature that we should all be using of on-chain Bitcoin is your savings account. And then these other versions and currencies that are intended to be transacted with are your spending account. And that's a great leadership that you guys have taken in terms of nomenclature there.
Yeah, thank you. The one thing I want to point out is even though it looks really simple, there's a ton of complexity under the hood to make it work. Sure. So if you're using the Android version, there's a swap button on the main screen, but on iOS, it's on the marketplace page. Hopefully Apple will let us move it over there soon, but you know, they're just keeping people safe. But like that simple experience, being able to swap between your layer two Bitcoin and Tether and send over Lightning and all of that, it's actually a lot of complexity under the hood to deal with it. And it's getting better and better with every release. So we'll handle refunds better too. So it's right now you have to claim it. If a swap fails, you have to hit a button or you have to wait for it to come back. But we're implementing Taproot swaps in the new Bolts SDK, so API. So once that is done, it'll be automatic. So all this complexity, we try to offload it from the user, and we try to handle all of it in the background and keep the UI really simple and straightforward.
Yeah, that's good. The best products and the best UI reduce the complexity on the back end to simplicity on the front end. So love to see that. I look forward to using it. So I don't know if the answer will be simplicity or complexity here, but can you tell us more about just the overall general mission of JN3?
Well, the mission is to accelerate hyper-Bitcoinization. So accelerating Bitcoin adoption, getting us to the point where you don't have to go back to fiat. And that comes with a number of things. One is you have to push it forward and get people to understand Bitcoin. The second part is helping countries to implement systems at which they can transition into this new financial system. So if you think about it, if you have a country of 30 million people and they all needed to onboard into Bitcoin suddenly, that would be a very chaotic and disruptive event. So we're trying to get countries to have something today where people can gradually offboard into this new system. So potentially it's two systems in parallel. Maybe you're using the dollar still and you have Bitcoin accessible to a large swath of the population and infrastructure in place to facilitate that. So it's a multifaceted, multi-pronged mission that we have to get more Bitcoin adoption and help get the world ready for that hyper-Bitcoinized state.
Yeah, that's a worthy goal. Those of us in the conversation here think that's most likely coming. And so any work done now to help ease that transition will be good, I think, for everyone.
On that point, Samson, do you have any thoughts about like what are the things that could prevent that from occurring? Like, or do you view it as inevitable?
I would say it's inevitable. So Andy said earlier, if Bitcoin reaches its potential, I don't think it's a if, it's a when. And if you think about it, it's probably not going to be at a leisurely time frame. All these things, the legacy financial system is built on a house of cards, and these things tend to collapse very rapidly. So it's not likely that we're going to have a few decades to gradually transition. I have a feeling it's going to be a very sudden, rapid change that is going to end up being chaotic, even though we have the goal of making it an orderly transition. But yeah, I would say it's inevitable. If you look at all of the macro factors in the world economy, it's all pointing towards not good. Yeah. And people are looking for an escape hatch. This a few weeks ago, it was Lunar New Year, or Chinese New Year, and people were in China buying massive amounts of gold. Again, it's people seeking out the scarce, valuable asset that they know of. and that's gold in some cases. Some cases, it's the dollar. But people are looking for an escape route, and it's getting more and more evident. I mean, you could also look at the ETF inflows as an indicator of people seeking an escape hatch, right? It's just the smarter early money on Wall Street that was too lazy to buy physical Bitcoin is now buying the ETF. And even though they're later than, let's say, us, they're still relatively early in legacy finance. So I would say that's a strong indicator that things are starting to move towards that fiat failure.
Yeah. Yeah. Clearly, you're a gradually then suddenly adherent. And I sometimes think about this, like, if I guess I sort of characterize it in my own head of gradually, but exponentially, rather than the suddenly. Like I think it's a smooth exponential curve, rather than like a point in time where suddenly it becomes clear to everybody that they should buy some Bitcoin, you know, yesterday.
Yeah.
But I guess from a Bitcoiner perspective, it's kind of all the same. Like it's going to be a eternal September at some point.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty nasty. It's going to be a lot of scams. I can foresee a ton of people getting scammed out of their Bitcoin. I mean, who is it? Robert Kiyosaki said yesterday, you know, when the halving comes, your Bitcoin will double. The Bitcoin you have will double, not the Bitcoin's fiat value doubles. The number of Bitcoin you have will increase. So it's we're really early.
Robert, if you're listening, you're welcome to come on Scarce Assets podcast. We can have a conversation about this stuff. Agreed. We're very early.
Thanks for tuning in. If you're interested in exploring any of these topics further or want to learn more about how we can help you secure a new or existing Bitcoin allocation, get in touch with our team at onrampbitcoin.com. We look forward to supporting you on your Bitcoin journey.
Speaking of being early, you mentioned, I do actually want to go back to your recent comment here about, you know, gold buying in China. You have some experience with the Chinese market with respect to Bitcoin. I guess I'm curious, one, you know, are you still following it, generally speaking? And obviously, you know, billion plus people, it's hard to characterize it generally, but any comments you have on Bitcoin adoption in China over the last few years and today?
Well, I think a lot of people in China bought Bitcoin and still buy Bitcoin and definitely hold Bitcoin. So just as I gave you an example, in the Guatemalan Central Bank, you have people that have Bitcoin. A lot of people in China have Bitcoin and the government as well. People just want a scarce asset. The question is, do they understand that this is a scarce asset? If they do, then they probably have Bitcoin. But I would say the outlook for China is very positive because you have Hong Kong pushing forward spot ETFs now, and they seem to be on the verge of approval. And this is a tacit green light from Beijing that Bitcoin is okay now. So what's likely going to happen is a lot of the mainland capital will go to Hong Kong and buy the spot ETFs, along with the money in Hong Kong already. And they're trying to differentiate themselves. So I think I said this in Twitter spaces a couple weeks ago, but the Hong Kong ETFs are going to try to differentiate by offering in-kind creation and redemption.
Ah, good.
And I think Bitcoin Mag this morning posted it too. So it's definitely happened. And what we're seeing is a global competition to be the best vehicle and potentially the lowest fees down the road. So it's just a race to get Bitcoin for all these different areas, territories, and funds.
Yeah, that's it, right? The global competition. Different governments resist at different points in time, and yet they all seem to bend ultimately to the will of Bitcoin in the long run.
Yeah, Samson, do you think the Hong Kong ETFs is very clearly a response to Wall Street ETFs and Hong Kong as a, you know, with influence from China saying, we don't want to miss out, we're going to compete, we want to participate in this too. And so there's the game theory of Bitcoin playing out.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of the ETFs around the world have been waiting and watching the US. I mean, I don't know why, but people seem to think the US is a leader, so they're going to watch and see. But with the approval of the ETFs in the US, it sort of signifies that this is not going away. This is a new asset class, and it's here to stay. You have the largest asset manager on the planet, BlackRock, that is filing and accumulating Bitcoin on the behalf of their customers. You can't really say that you know, Bitcoin is used by criminals anymore. And actually, I'm really a big fan of the ETFs because it makes my job far easier engaging with nation states. Because the moment someone says, well, criminals use it, I say, well, no, BlackRock does. Whether you think BlackRock are bad or good, that's your problem. But it's the largest asset manager on the planet, period. End of discussion. So it simplifies that whole discourse about Bitcoin and is it okay or not okay.
I also have to wonder. I also have to wonder about, you know, my sense, having no firsthand information, was that historically, Bitcoin mining was a valve for capital flight out of China in prior years. I would have to imagine that certain members of the ruling party there have realized that, oh well, if the demand's going to be there, you know, we might as well siphon some of it off into a vehicle that if push came to shove, you know, maybe we could take the keys and or exert some control. Oh, and by the way, we probably have some more visibility, better know your customer info on the inflows into an ETF product as opposed to, you know, coins sold for cash out of mining operations. You think that's true?
Probably. I would say they should like the ETFs because it's a nice, regulated, controllable vehicle for whoever wants to control it. And, you know, people might invest in it for whatever reasons, but as long as you know what the thing is, if you understand the nature of the beast, it's okay, right? But yeah, I would say it is that competition factor, and it is a way to right some wrongs. They probably shouldn't have cracked down on mining so hard. And this is a way to say we were wrong without saying we were wrong. Maybe. I don't know. That's my intuition. But definitely, they don't want to miss the boat. And if you look at the macro situation in China, a lot of problems are emerging. Like the stock market is down massively. No one wants to invest in that. And the real estate market is being trashed heavily, and it's down massively too. So what can you really invest in? You need some hard assets. So that leaves gold and Bitcoin. And given that the US is apparently going all in to Bitcoin, I mean, if you look at total inflows, it's what, 6 billion something now? I think someone just woke up and realized you can't miss this train. So that's why they're going to start pushing it.
Yeah, I think that's right. So speaking of not missing the train, I enjoyed a post you put out, I think pretty recently, which said, many people think they'll always be able to buy Bitcoin. This is not true. And you have an image, which is a graph. I think x-axis is time and y-axis is price. And it's divided into two sections. And the first section is buying Bitcoin, and the second is earning Bitcoin. Can you tell us a little bit more about that framing?
Yeah, so the idea there is once Bitcoin is just simply money, you won't be able to buy it. You might be able to trade gold for it or some other scarce asset, but you won't be able to convert dollars into it, just like you don't really convert seashells into dollars these days. You kind of do, but it's not the norm. So if you're getting a salary paid out in Bitcoin and potentially denominated in Bitcoin, you don't get to buy Bitcoin anymore. That's called working, right? So you're buying Bitcoin with your time, which by definition is working. So that's really the meaning behind it, that you will come a day where you just earn Bitcoin. It's not about buying Bitcoin anymore.
Yeah, that makes sense. And your view, I think, is that day could be pretty close, might not be too far away. So let's get a little bullish here. You've said recently that you expect $1 million per Bitcoin price, I think, by the end of next year, 2025. You know, Mike, I guess my question about that is, what might be the facts and circumstances surrounding that kind of an event? I mean, are you just assuming kind of a normal bull market with a blow off top, or are you assuming some other kind of event, including, you know, the gradually to suddenly type of scenario?
I'm leaning more towards that suddenly, and as Jesse said, maybe exponentially. So we'll see. But I think my prediction was this year. I actually thought it would have happened already, but perhaps it was muted by this grayscale sell-off, and it depressed it. But we know that the demand was there because we see the $6 billion net inflows of cash coming into these ETFs. And we know that even when there's a net outflow week, price can still go up. So the buying is not constrained simply to the ETFs. There is more buying. There's spot buying. Surprise, surprise. But I think this year we should hit 1 million at the latest next year. And it's going to come as a shock, I think, to a lot of people because they think that we have, you know, a decade or maybe a few more halvings before we reach that. But if you look at the state of the current system, every 100 days, the U.S. is $1 trillion further in debt. That's a lot of Bitcoin. So, you know, $1 million Bitcoin is still just a drop in the bucket when you compare it to how fast money is being printed.
Yeah, the way you framed it there, every $1 trillion worth of debt, I mean, that's the current market cap roughly of or network value of Bitcoin today. It's pretty sobering.
Yeah. I agree with you that, like, if the world understood Bitcoin would already be worth more than $1 million per coin. Mm-hmm. I guess I always fall back to, like, it has taken so much longer for people to wake up to Bitcoin, and it goes so much slower just because of that. Not to say that, you know, the inevitable isn't happening, but that humans are so slow to realize that they're wrong and then act accordingly to, you know, fix their mistakes. And for that reason, I hope that you're right. And I hope that I am pleasantly surprised this year or next year, but I'm prepared to be disappointed on that front, you know?
Well, disappointment would be better because that means we're going to see a slow, gradual increase.
Yeah.
I also put out there my concept of max pain theory, which is the most painful situation for the most number of people is the most likely outcome. So that massive rapid increase in Bitcoin to 1 million would price out a lot of the developing world in a meaningful change. Also the governments too. They wouldn't be able to pull in El Salvador and get, you know, a couple thousand Bitcoin, right? They might be getting 2 Bitcoin. So then the disparity in the world would maintain itself. The rich would still be rich, and then the poor would still be poor. So the best case scenario for the world is a gradual, steady tick up to 1 million, where everyone can learn and realize that they're wrong about Bitcoin and get into it before it's too late. But, you know, Max Payne theory says they're not going to have that chance.
Yeah. But maybe that's where, like, I don't know, some sort of cosmic karma comes in here, and the hubris of the last 50 years, maybe call it a few hundred years of Western finance, causes people who have benefited from the system to be the slowest to adopt this new currency, and people in developing countries who have a more immediate need for it benefit by adopting earlier on the whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we'll have to start a new podcast. We'll call it Cosmic Karma, and we'll talk to early adopters in developing countries, and hopefully we'll find more of them than we actually think exist.
But here's another metric to think about. So during COVID, I guess it started in 19, right? COVID-19. We're about 5 years post COVID pandemic, and we shut down the world, we printed trillions of dollars, and this year, I don't know if you noticed, or maybe the tail end of last year, people started feeling that pain of inflation and not being able to pay their bills and rent being astronomical, and basically their way of living is no longer sustainable, right? So it takes about 5 years for these changes to really get out there, maybe 3 to 5 years. So I would say we're getting close to the time at which it's been 5 years since a massive amount of money was printed, because the pandemic first happened, then lockdowns ramped up. So maybe this year to next year is when we see the 5-year mark after that massive amount of money printing first began. So, you know, the world adjusts roughly on this time frame, and we should see something happen. But I want to ask you guys, what is your prediction? You shouldn't leave me out here with my bold prediction.
No, very fair. So before the ETFs, I was predicting, you know, kind of what everybody has been predicting of like 120 to 160, and then we'll just repeat the cycles. But with the ETFs and the scale of demand and the fact that, you know, ETFs alone as a demand source has been averaging like 8 to 10x our daily supply issuance from mining in terms of demand, if that sustains, this goes way higher. You know, maybe it's 250, maybe 350. That's sort of what I'm shifting from my expectation of like, you know, mid hundreds towards, okay, maybe it's much higher. And I've gotten to the point where I'm comfortable with like, okay, 250, maybe even more than that. I do think that the human nature and human psychology will precipitate another bubble. Because there will be irrational exuberance. People will overextend themselves. And then when the tide starts to go out, the reflexivity goes in the other direction and we have a crash of some sort. I don't know what that peak is from. Like, do we get to 1 million and then we crash down to 300,000? That'd be incredible. But though a little bit alarming because of the rate of change that would imply about the world. I guess at this point, my expectation is 250, maybe 350, and then like a 70% crash and we do it all again.
All right. So I'll be the resident bear, I guess. Not bullish enough. So I actually, Samson, you know, earlier in my journey, because I was class 2017, I got very bulled up. And for me, it was like, this is happening now, right? I was very excited. Hyper-Bitcoinization is upon us. And then the crash. And then a couple cycles in. And now I am actually more optimistic that it's likely to be a gradual transition in the sense that it could be, I don't know, a couple more cycles. So like, would not surprise me at all if a decade from now, you know, fiat money is in a minor role. But I sort of don't expect it this cycle. But my logic is that if we saw a pump to $1 million, let's say, I still think that governments have enough levers to pull, including just with respect to shutting off fiat access to the on-ramps, to the exchanges, basically. And so I think if they can restrict, you know, fiat flow, dollar flow, and other fiats onto the exchanges while still allowing sales, then just the sales, that is, of, you know, Bitcoin into dollars or other fiat, then maybe that sort of manipulated supply-demand balance could precipitate a crash or a downward move like we've seen in prior cycles. So that's my thoughts. But you've been at this longer and you're much better connected and you understand the system much better than I do. So tell me what's wrong with that hypothesis that the governments could pull a few levers and dump the price.
Well, governments can always pull a few levers, but the thing is, I think there is enough adoption in the world today that it's sort of outside of their control at this point. I mean, the U.S. should be under rule of law, so they can't just, I mean, they can always 6102 all the Bitcoin held in Coinbase custody, but I don't know if that is palatable in this day and age, and if it's politically endurable for any president these days. I mean, back in the time of, the old dark ages without internet, it's much easier to do these types of things. But nowadays, with super connectivity and always people always online and TikToks and the ability to reach the masses directly through Twitter, X, whatever, Noster, it's much harder, I think, to quietly steal from people. So that leaves some legal way to crash the market. And again, I think it would be the U.S. because that's one of the largest and people would follow the U.S. I don't think there's a really easy legal way for them to tank this stuff. Once you have an ETF approved, whether it's spot or futures, it's incredibly difficult to unwind because these structures are designed to just last forever. So like, if you want to talk about the Ethereum ETF, they approved the futures one. And if they want to untangle that, and because they don't want to approve the spot one, I don't know if they could unwind the futures ETF. It's not, these are, things are not designed to be shut down. So they could at most, and again, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know. The most they could do is probably prevent new inflows and then let people redeem it. But if people don't redeem it, I don't think there's a way for them to just arbitrarily close it. So I think it's really challenging for the US to shut it down now that it's out and done. And this is why I think they're going to draw the line on additional crypto ETFs, because they don't want to be approving Shiba Inu and Baby Floki ETFs, which they would have to by law and precedent if they approved Ethereum spot ETF.
I've got a new product idea. It's called ETF with hat. What do you think? Is that a good idea?
I'll buy a few shares.
I want to circle back to make the case for why I see Samson's $1 million as possible, having presented the other side of it. But, you know, I think there is a more at this point in time than any time before a case to be made that this bull market will be bigger than the last because of the way that the bull market last cycle was muted in a couple ways in 2021. First, the China mining ban, sort of taking the legs out from the parabolic advance. And then, of course, the pivot from QE to QT at the end of the year, which really took the wind out of sails and stopped the bull market at 69,000. So if we should have had, without those variables, if we were going to have a blow off top to $200,000 per Bitcoin, which sounds a little wild, but wouldn't have been that out of line with prior patterns. I mean, 2013 top was $1,000. 2017 top was $20,000. So 20x from top to top, and then to go to 200,000 would be a 10x. If we would have gotten that all else equal. And now we're in an environment where those short-term circumstances that caused the top to not go as high as it would have been to now not be present or even reversed, because we might have a switch from QT to QE. Mm-hmm. Then
don't forget all the fraud.
Yes, right. And the FTX selling Bitcoin to buy altcoins when customers thought they were holding Bitcoin, all of that. The paper Bitcoin that FTX and probably others were doing. If we don't have that, if you assume that we quote unquote got to 200,000 from like a an alternate universe situation, and now we're back in that alternate universe because things are normal again. Mm-hmm. Could we get a 5x from top to top? That would be very reasonable when you look at it that way. So there's the case for we get back to where we should have gotten.
Once we get to 0.1M, it's just 10x to a million. So
I do love that framing.
Thanks. But I think the most important thing that we need to look at is simply the dollar is already dead. It stopped having meaning basically after COVID and maybe the war with Ukraine, because it's no longer a reserve asset for the world. You can't keep dollars that can be taken away. And with geopolitics the way it is, like, why would China place value in the dollar when it can be just yanked out from under them like a altcoin rug pull? You wouldn't do that as a major world power. You need something else. The question is, again, what we talked about, when do they realize that it's Bitcoin, right? When that realization comes, it changes everything. But money really is already dead. Like, what is $1 trillion? Every 100 day, $1 trillion. $1 trillion is a massive amount of money. If you were actually to print it out, it's something like the size of a football field. That's how much paper volume it would take. It's really big. So if we're printing $1 trillion every 100 days, and recently I think you have another $2.1 trillion bill for spending, I mean, it's really lost all of its meaning there. A dollar is really meaningless. The only reason it's still used is simply because it's a unit of account and medium of exchange. Like a chocolate bar and a house is kind of priced in a dollar, rapidly increasing, but people are still hanging on by that thread. It's only because it's the unit of account. It's not because of the medium exchange, because you're limited in transfers now, and especially in the EU. And it's not a store of value because, I mean, look at the printing involved. So it's just hanging on by a thread. It's dangling on by a tiny thread. So a million is not crazy when you look at trillions and trillions just printed at the snap of a finger.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And the denominator is moving. Yeah. The numerator is moving. Like, people are realizing, oh, Bitcoin is scarce and it's valuable. And so the purchasing power should be higher. And then, as you're pointing out, oh yeah, also the denominator is getting debased rapidly.
Yeah. And $1 million is only 2% of global assets. Like, that's what that would make Bitcoin, just 2% of the world's assets.
And unit of accounts are really sticky. To get off of that as a unit of account, it takes a really jarring shock to the system, right? Like, at which point as a shopkeeper would you reprice a Snickers bar in Bitcoin? It's really hard to get over that, right? Even if you understand Bitcoin is money, you kind of need that comfort of that dollar unit of account. So a shock to the system is exactly probably what's going to happen that pushes them over. But it's just hanging on by a thin thread.
Yep. And that's one of the things the skeptics, I think, struggle with Bitcoin, is they assume that it should have been a medium of exchange by now. If it was successful, we're 15 years into this thing, people would be transacting with it. And occasionally in some places they are. But your point is a good one, which is the later, store value comes first and unit of account and medium of exchange come later. And but it could be rapid. Okay, so we're coming up on time here, but I want to switch gears real fast. So you went to school in Canada, I believe. I've been to several parts of Canada, and they're all lovely. And I know a bunch of Canadians who relocated to America, but I don't know that many who went the other way. Any thoughts on why this is?
Because Canada's going downhill for the same reasons the US is. But I mean, we're a smaller economy and things get worse faster here and more easily. So inflation is very painful for a lot of people. Like, you see those TikTok videos, a lot of them are from Canadians that say they can't afford basic things and paying basic necessities and paying their rent. And it has to do with the fact that we also printed a lot of money too. I think we printed $1 trillion, and $1 trillion for Canada is just absolutely bonkers given the size of our economy and our population. So, when the US is capable of doing that and absorbing that effect, Canada doesn't really do that. So you see a rise in crime, a degradation in society in general, and more desperation. So everything is just in decline right now. New immigrants are leaving Canada because they can't afford to come here. They immigrated thinking, we're going to earn some money in Canada and send it back home, but they can't even pay their own bill, so they end up just going. So that's how bad it is here.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's a sobering perspective. I guess the message is, good idea to have at least a little Bitcoin, heading into ongoing money printing and debt and deficits and all that stuff. Well, Samson, you've been really generous with your time. I want to give you a chance to, give us a handoff. Tell us where they can learn more about you or your work.
Sure. Our website is gen3.com, and you can find us on X, Twitter at gen3com. And then my handle is at Excellion, Excellion.
All right. Well, thank you again, Samson. This has been a tremendous conversation. Really appreciate it. And this has been Scarce Assets.
Thanks, Andy. Thanks, Jesse.